Velkommen tilbage til endnu en Kina Nørder Special. I dag der skal vi dykke mere ned i de to møder. Og Mads, det skal vi gøre med en af dine venner.
Ja, det skal vi, fordi der er simpelthen en af mine rigtig gode venner fra Kina, som er nordmand, som er kommet oppe fra Norge med Oslobåden simpelthen, for at komme herned og optage en podcast.
Ikke fiertøjet, men bierbåden.
Bierbåden.
Oslobåden. Og det gør så også, at på vores lytters skyld, så kommer vi til at lave den her podcast på engelsk.
Ja.
Selvom det gør ondt i hjertet på mig, når skandinaver taler engelsk med hinanden, så tænker vi, at der skal nok sidde nogen derude, der måske ikke er så stærke i norsk, at vi må hellere gøre det, så vi får alle med. Så kan vi også se, om vi får et udenlandsk publikum. Men Alan Dick, welcome to the show.
Yeah, welcome.
Thank you.
Pleasure having you.
Absolutely. I'm here in Copenhagen with you guys, and it's rainy, and it's great.
Yeah, great weather. You can't tell if it's spring, fall, winter, or summer. It's all the same. Alan, for our listeners, could you introduce yourself, and how did you get started with China?
Yeah, okay. So I started with China in 2008. I was attracted by the Olympics. I was there, went to a lot of the attractions, saw Usain Bolt many times. And I just got very curious about this country, and I've been studying China ever since.
What was your background? Education and work?
Right. So I think I studied at the time languages, and I had done Hebrew. I studied Middle East and politics, and I was traveling around in the Middle East. And then I ended up in China and did Chinese as my kind of second language. And the startup social anthropology study program.
Was there anything specific about China that got you hooked, so to say, on China? Was it the political system or culture or all of the above?
Yeah, I think it was the Olympics and the rise of China that was very evident at that time. And it was, of course, something different, and I had to understand it. And I'm still stuck with that challenge.
Well, I think we all are.
Yeah.
What is China? Where is China going? It's also why we have this podcast. Try and figure that out. We'll probably never get anywhere close to figuring it out. So, Liang Hui, the two sessions, as they're called, why should we deal or care about the two sessions? Why are they important?
All right, so the two sessions is part of China's quite regular policy cycle. So every year they have two sessions. And this time it's particularly important because they are changing a lot of the personnel, including the premier. Usually every 10 years they change the president. This time that didn't happen. So it's a special one this year.
And should also mention that one of the first times that we met out in Beijing, Alan, was 5 years ago, right after the Liang Hui back then.
After the 90th Party Congress?
Yeah. So in 2018, that was also really landmark Liang Hui, two meetings, because there was a great government restructure ring. And does it ring any bells? Well, it's more or less the same thing that happened this year, right? So, Alan, you are doing some work that I really admire a lot at China Policy. And back then, I remember that in the Nordic Chambers of Commerce, we invited all our company heads to an event where you were basically laying out all the important key takeaways from the Liang Hui back then. Yeah. And so what happened in the past 5 years from 2018 up to now? Why is this Liang Hui this year so important?
Yeah, you have the feeling that every of these big meetings in China is important, and the next more important than the other. Yeah, so the 5 years ago, of course, that was the first one after they announced the new era. And the new era has kind of some new targets for where the Communist Party want to go and how they want to modernize the country. So, in the 5 years since, of course, they've been obstructed by first trade war.
Thank you, Mr. Trump.
And then this 3 year with COVID. Sure. So I think we're still in this new era, kind of early phase. And you see a lot of these initiatives that was taken back then now reappearing. But I think, it's important to draw the longer kind of lines when you analyze and think that this one is more important than the other. They, of course, build on each other.
Mm.
Some things probably are not continuing, and then there are some new circumstances that makes this one special. But of course, that is part of this policy cycle that the Lianhui kind of belongs to, is that regularly they need to kind of retune their music, and then they start banging on a new drum or a new rhythm. Yeah.
Maybe for our listeners, could you say, I mean, because we have the 14th five-year plan was some years ago, and now we have this Lianhui. Why are they not together after the party congress? Why don't you set new a five-year plan after a party congress? Why are they not in sync, so to say?
Yeah, so they're all part of these policy cycles, which have been quite regular. And although Xi Jinping has disrupted it slightly with his move to stay on, but yeah, they have a kind of a, you know, they do policy and they do economy at a certain time, and they do so they don't change the policy for the whole system kind of every time, but they do they have different focuses. So I think this kind of every 5 years they focus on, well, restructuring their administration. So that's what we've just witnessed.
Yeah. So I mean, you just said the restructuring and the reforms that we've seen. What are like the three biggest things or the five biggest takeaways from this year's two sessions that you have taken particularly notice of?
Yeah, okay. That's a tough one.
You can narrow it down and just say like the few things that you
think. I think we need to take maybe a step back and notice what was maybe the number one kind of big takeaway that I'm having is that Xi Jinping and the new Politburo Standing Committee, 1 month, slightly 1 month before the Lianhui, they went to the party school and they talked, they had a study session on what they call the Chinese-style modernization.
Mm-hmm.
So this was a very clear signal and a message that they now wanted to talk about where are we really heading? And I think at that meeting, according to the reports, Xi Jinping said that we need to develop our own type of modernization, which is not this Western style modernization, which is very much focused on the economy and efficiency. Our modernization needs to go beyond that, and it needs to suit China, which has a big population. It needs to take more account of environmental constraints and so on. But I think also what he said at that meeting is that we don't really know how to get there.
Mm-hmm.
So he really opened up, and that's why I think he had at the Central Party School, is that he kind of signaled that we need to talk about this instead of only kind of having this rhetorical kind of fight with the West that this, what you're doing is not what we want to do. They need to come up with alternatives. So I think that sets kind of the premise for the new team coming in, is that this team, and back to your question about this five-year plan, the kind of the goals are set. They kind of know where slightly where they're going, but there are a lot of contradictions that they're facing. They don't know exactly how they're going to do this step by step. But yeah, so if you look at what actually happened during Lianhui, of course, the agency restructure is maybe the most significant. And I would like to focus then on the SciTech restructuring and that they are very concerned that some of these special emerging technologies, especially the semiconductors, is not something that China currently master, and that they set up a new structure, governance structure, that's going to break through in this sector.
And not only that they do not master it, the US, they are actively trying to hamper efforts to develop.
Yeah. Because they know that's where they can hurt China the most. And we know that semiconductors are crucial for all of China's other technological innovation ambitions. You need the microchips to feed into that.
There's a lot of focus, of course, that China has a lot of strongholds in these emerging technologies like new energy vehicles or critical minerals and so on. But the thing with critical minerals is you know, why are we not doing it in, well, especially Norway or in Denmark?
I think they found just a lot in Sweden as well.
Well, it's because it comes with, you know, some issues, environmental issues and so on. And we're quite happy that China is doing that job for us at the moment. It's not that critical, right? But for China, when it comes to semiconductors, that's critical. But that's something that the US can kind of prevent them from getting. And then, their plans are falling apart. So they set up, it seems like they've set up a system similar to what they did in the 50s when they developed a nuclear bomb.
Wow.
Because that was a similar kind of issue that, you know, the US and other countries had then developed a nuclear bomb. China didn't have it. And they had to quickly develop this technology. So they set up this special commission back then and they developed it. So that's a similar kind of structure it seems like they're putting in place now.
Yeah, there's a lot of anecdotes from that time as well, right? There's one anecdote about there was Russian advisors also a part of this project. And then the Sino-Soviet split happened, of course. And one story says that Chinese scientists painstakingly assembled some shredded documents that could sort of tell parts of the process of developing the atomic bomb. Yeah. Anyway,
I don't know that story, but it's they have there are things that they have learned from their history that they're now bringing back. That's for sure. Mm. And the party obviously is getting a more direct control over these critical issues, including the other big change, which is the financial sector.
Mm.
But and we can talk more about that when it comes to what role does these different entities, what is the role of the party, what is the role of state, what is the role of companies, what is the role of private companies, what's the role of foreign entities, and so on. I think they have a clearer kind of view on this after the Lianhui.
If we take the huge helicopter perspective, because we talk, at least in Denmark as well, in the media, Xi Jinping, he's tightening the grip of power. He's the new emperor. He's a dictator. China's going to invade Taiwan, the rivalry with the US. What is the overall goal of Xi Jinping? I mean, we know that he has a goal set towards 2049, the 100th year of the founding of the People's Republic of China. But what is his goal? Is it just power for the sake of power? Why does he need all these reforms? I mean, what is his goal? Broadly speaking, of course.
Yeah, so I think I refuse to kind of say Xi Jinping's goal. I think we need to kind of acknowledge that Xi Jinping's goals are Chinese goals and vice versa. I think, you know, many people like to compare kind of Xi and Putin, but I think, you know, if Putin passes away, I think Russia has kind of an issue of leadership. Yeah. But I don't think the same thing is in China. I think there is a kind of a team around him that he trusts, but are also very capable of bringing kind of issues and solutions to the table. So Xi Jinping's job is to ensure China's success like I said, modernization. That's clearly articulated now. But what that means is not necessarily up to him. That belongs to a series of advisors and people on the ground that will implement this ambition.
And if we look at the people, as you were just mentioning, there were, of course, a number of positions that were filled at this Lianhui this year. And there's been a lot of talk of primarily Xi assuming the presidentship for a third term. And also Li Qiang, right? They have really been the two major people that have been focused on. But besides them, Alan, who would you say have been notable personnel changes?
Yeah, so I think it is notable that Wang Huning stays on as in a very central position. Wang Huning is kind of considered the top intellectual in China. He has been considered the brain of Jiang Zemin in the 90s and the brain of Hu Jintao in the 2000s, and equally the brain of Xi Jinping now for 10 years. And he is continuing in this role. But obviously, he is now part of the Politburo Standing Committee, and he's been there for the last 5 years as well.
He was supposed to retire.
Well, maybe some people thought so, but he's obviously still there.
Yeah.
And his new role is to head this Chinese political
the Chinese People's Political Consultative Conference.
Right, CPPCC.
That's always hard to
get that. Which is one of these two meetings. Mm. So that's the talk shop where many influential people, Communist Party members, members from other political organizations, chairmen of SOEs, experts from different think tanks and engineers and whatnot, come together and they provide questions and solutions to the National People's Congress. And so they tackle, they're supposed to tackle issues and come with advice, both to the NPC but also to the State Council. And Wang Huning now sits on top of that system, which I think is notable, because if you have kind of the big brain, you know, working in Zhongnanhai as part of kind of whispering in Xi Jinping and other leaders' ears, that's one thing. But now he has a whole kind of
bureaucracy
really
under
him, with not just some bureaucrats but like real executives. I think that this body will be able, or they hope will be able, to solve some of these contradictions. How should China tackle both economic kind of progress, but also tackle the climate change crisis? I think this is the body that will handle that, like sort these things out. Mm. Yes, the State Council and the ministries will still have a job, but these kind of intellectual kind of thought processes, I think it's going to happen through this this talk shop.
And maybe with the climate crisis and all this, and the Chinese people as a whole, of course, there are marginalized groups and minorities, people in Hong Kong, the Uyghurs, and all of that, and Taiwan. I think a lot of people would say that China is a horrible dictatorship, doesn't care about the people, it's authoritarian, it's a surveillance state. Does Xi Jinping and the party actually care about the Chinese people?
it's a tough question. We need to draw some comparison to kind of democracies, liberal democracies. So a leader, for instance, in Norway or Denmark would, you know, go to election and they get 50%, more than 50% of the votes with their coalition partners, and they rule the country. And in a few years, there will be a change and some others will lead. Obviously, that's not the case in China. That's a dictatorship. But that also means that Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party, they need to answer to everyone. They need to find a policy that suits kind of the left and the right. So that is obviously a challenging thing. And usually you'll find them more in the middle of those kind of that political spectrum. So what I do in my job is often to kind of look at what China are we talking about? Are we talking about, because you can very often look at a policy debate in China, whether, I mean, ethnic minorities, how to handle, and then you would get kind of six different voices, school of thoughts. Mm. It's not political parties, but it's still there under that umbrella. And it's kind of Xi Jinping's job to find, strike the balance. It's a matter of your subject. Kind of opinion, if you're successful or not. Yeah. I don't want to answer that question.
I think a lot of people in the West, at least, would argue that it's a horrible way of governing China. But I mean, you could say not to condone the behavior, because I think a lot of people in the free liberal democracies in the West would disagree with the way they're ruling their people and would not prefer not to be governed in that regard. But it is that he has a higher purpose for China that he wants to reach, come hell or high water. So people standing in the way, be they Uyghurs or people in Hong Kong wanting their democracy, tough luck. There's a bigger picture that I want to reach. And then
true, but I also think that they're very well aware that they're not, this is not the end of their kind of reform. Mm. I mean, they know that they need to improve. So I think that's very central to this as well, is that they are not very happy to be called out for the human rights abuses, but which many would agree with. But yeah, it's a challenging job.
Talking about Wang Huning, as you just did before, I think it's interesting that Wang Huning has also been credited with another concept that is being propagated, has been so for the past couple of years, called whole process democracy,
yeah,
right? Which is, again, trying to revamp some of these different organs of the state. This idea of the whole process democracy is sort of trying to show the Chinese people, oh, we have a new way that we're trying to, what can you say, sell our governance model back to you. So that is about legitimacy of the government and legitimacy of the party. So I think what does Xi Jinping care about? It is building legitimacy with the majority of Chinese, right? Because if you create a system of governance that is making the majority unhappy, you're going to have a change of systems, right?
Yeah, especially while they're progressing and getting more affluent. That is a challenging job. So yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. That's a very good way to look at it.
And party survival and party legitimacy, one of the primary things are the economy and economic growth. And we saw also at the two sessions a new BNP growth target, 5%. Would you, and it has been called a modest, unambitious growth rate. How do you view this? Do you agree or?
Yeah, so I'm not really an economist. And I know that, this sells headlines in the West and in China for that matter. But I think it's, for me, it's the way I look at it is that the 5% target kind of signals how active the government will be, what I and some other call the project system, which is ensuring economic activities, which is run by the NDRC, National Development and Reform Commission, and is also part of this five-year plan kind of system. So that's traditionally how China has kind of done development. And I think the growth target has been away for a few years, right? And now it's back. So they are kind of signaling to the system that, yeah, we will ensure that these projects are going along. Of course, now with rising global inflation, things will cost more, steel and energy and so on to import. So it's not given that the government will support this, but they're kind of signaling we will still modestly support this. But the overall kind of, if you look at how they're trying to run the country's economy, I think they're trying to move away from this project system. So it's not only kind of growth and kind of economic activities that matter, but a range of indicators. So I think that they're, and as part of this kind of transition towards a more quality-based kind of economy or society, you see big reforms happening in the financial sector and moving away from kind of controlling projects and companies towards controlling more of the money flow. And that we see clear kind of movements towards. And that would be a new system. And I think that's the more interesting part of the puzzle, if you want to understand where the Chinese economy is moving.
And Mas and I have talked a lot in this podcast as well about the growth model. As you also said, and Michael Pettis also said that China needs to change the growth model and focus a lot more on household consumption and getting the amount of household consumption as part of the overall economy, boost that. Otherwise, China is going to end up in the middle income trap. China's never going to become rich. It's going to become old before it gets rich. And we've heard this countless of times as well. And a thing that has been talked about since Xi Jinping assumed leadership in 2013 is that you need to reform the Chinese state-owned enterprises. That is a huge chunk of the economy. And people joke that in order to get rich in China, you need to know how to code, like a program. But the majority of the richest people in China became rich through state-owned enterprises. And there's a huge local interest in China's local government. So state-owned enterprises and reform for Xi Jinping, is that realistic? Is that something that he and Andy Chang and others, are they going to tackle this right now? Or how do you see this versus consumption as a share of BNP growth?
All right. So yeah, many things there. And it goes a bit back to this kind of division of roles in the country. Well, the SOEs are, you know, located in the strategic areas of the economy. And they stand for a kind of a significant amount of kind of the economy, but you know, they're not really the driver of economic growth per se, but they control areas such as energy almost completely. By the of course, we can talk about the energy sector as a good example, because still till this day the government sets the price for what the companies can charge to the consumer. So they're kind of artificially holding the energy price low so that Chinese industries and exporting companies can take advantage of cheap electricity and cheap energy. So, yeah, this is not necessarily the most efficient way. So they have announced a series of plans to reorganize the economy away from this kind of planned state protected economy towards a more efficient model. I think this is a bit of a longer term plan. The big kind of catchphrase right now is this demand side growth.
Yeah, that's also what Michael Pittas also argued, that there's been focusing so much on the supply side. We've seen like huge infrastructure projects. I mean, building railroads, building huge highways, mega cities that are for the large part uninhabited, that they need to focus on the demand side, that they need to boost the household demands and need to get the Chinese consumers to spend a lot of more money. And we've seen a tendency, at least of this revenge spending after COVID, that the consumers are actually starting to get the money out of their mattresses or wherever they're hiding it. Probably don't trust banks a lot anymore, because the financial sector as well, which is also a part of Lianghui, that we see more party control over the financial sector in China. So is that also a way to send a signal to Chinese consumers that, hey, it's safe to have your monies in the banks, but please rather invest them into society?
Yeah, so I mean, the way they think about this is that over the next until 2030, 2035, there is still kind of a transition period where the government need to be active to build up kind of the economy that's going to be, you know, demand-led versus the current kind of planned, you know, with a lot of kind of government involvement. So we will see that over time. In energy, in the energy sector, you see that, you know, there is the government's job through the SOEs to build this new green capacity.
Yep.
So you see that they're building massive amounts of power capacity of solar and wind in the Chinese desert at the moment. But there are many questions on how you're going to move away from this kind of, project based, where you kind of make money and you grow the economy by building, till to kind of, where you have an economy where the consumption side is kind of deciding what you're going to grow in the society, and at what price. So that's, of course, the big question that is not very clear at the moment. Presumably, in this transition, you would see a lot of these prices that is now kind of kept low because the government is protecting it. It's going to be higher, but it's not given, because we are living in a kind of an age where you have a lot of technological developments, especially in the digital realm.
Mm.
And I think that that's another field that requires a lot of attention from us kind of China watchers now, is to understand how the Chinese government think about governing data and governing and kind of who sets the price and value, and who can use, who has the ownership for these kind of new technologies now emerging.
Mm.
And I think China is much more hands-on than many other countries.
We talked about this in our last podcast.
Yeah.
We talked about the data bureau, or some call it data ministry, right?
So that administration is probably the right one.
That was set up during the Lianghui, to my knowledge.
Under NDRC.
Yeah, but does something like that exist in like in other places in the world? I think it shows something about where the Chinese state is heading.
And that is under NDRC is, of course, the key to understand here is under the planning system.
Yeah.
So, of course, China has a lot of data kind of governing bodies. They have actually, I think, 14 spread around different ministries. So you have under the state administration market regulation, you have kind of the one that should regulate monopolies.
Mm.
But yeah, that they place such a kind of bureau administration under NDRC tells you that they want to plan this a bit better.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually, in the announcement, they were kind of giving two roles and they both said, well, they're going to coordinate this sector. Mm-hmm. But they don't really have power per se. It's similar to the National Energy Administration, actually.
Yeah.
The one that kind of also sits under NDRC and is in charge of China's energy sector. But they also don't have really teeth to regulate the sector. So yeah, that system is still developing. And I think they haven't really made up their mind on how to govern it. But at the same time, because I think the kind of the premise is that they develop these new technologies that going to be so central in the future society.
And just one last question about the SOEs, or the state-owned enterprises. So I think some of our listeners, they may have heard about the Iron Rice Bowl that basically became sort of the symbol, or breaking the Iron Rice Bowl, as it is often described, became the symbol of sort of the breakup of many of the state-owned enterprises in the 80s and 90s. And so as we were talking about before, many researchers, many China watchers thought it was a tendency that would continue. But really, how do you think she sees the state-owned enterprises, their role, or not only she, but the Xi administration in society today?
Yeah, so the SOEs have, I mean, you need to look at each single individual SOEs. And so there are 98, I think, on national level, and there are thousands of them on the local level. And they each have kind of different kind of objective. I can speak to the energy ones that I know the most. And I think it's very interesting to see the five. There are five coal or power generators.
Mm.
So traditionally they had one as part of the planning. It was kind of a ministry and that was in charge of electricity production. But then they wanted more competition, so they kind of divided into five. And they all got their own assets in different geographies. But of course now with the energy transition, they need to move away from coal. So that's a mandate that they have, is that they need to develop a green kind of portfolio. By 2025, these five companies each need to have more than 50% capacity in renewable.
Mm.
And so that's one goal of the SOEs, that they use them to drive these national goals to build capacity. But I think another very important one is that they need to make money for the state. Like the tax system in China is not very developed. So they rely a lot on SOEs to provide in that are basically having monopolies or very lucrative businesses, not much competition. And they need to provide money. And the interesting thing about the coal companies now is that because the price for electricity is set lower than the price that the coal power companies need to buy the raw coal for, they are losing a lot of money. So that creates a massive incentive for them to move towards a new energy system where they're allowed to kind of make money.
Mm.
But then they have a third objective as well, and that is, of course, to provide energy security. You've seen a lot of stories about this power shortages in China. Yeah. That's not allowed, basically. These companies need to make sure that the power generators are spinning. Mm. So even if they make lose money. So currently, these SOEs are losing a lot of money. So it would be very interesting to see how they manage to balance all these assignments that they've been given from their master, the government.
I mean, we talked a lot about corruption as well. And Xi Jinping also had his anti-corruption campaign that's been rolling ever since.
Hmm.
How is the corruption right now within the state-owned enterprises? Have they cleaned up thoroughly, or are there still pockets of corruption, and how do you see corruption as a as a problem for state-owned enterprise reforms.
Exactly. So I think, I mean, traditionally there are there, and there's still this system of kind of investigations and you need to file reports and so on. More and more you see that they're moving towards a system where the SOEs are kind of evaluated based on a range of indicators, and economic kind of growth or profits is only one of them. I mean, they're measured on like environmental kind of progress and many indicators. So I think the government will be less willing to kind of investigate each and every single party official in these companies. Moreover, look at what's the end result. Are you improving this company? Mm. If not, move to the side.
Like, speaking of, because we talked about the semiconductors, right? Mm. You saw that there was this huge corruption scandal, which...
Yeah, with a big fund.
Exactly. Yeah. But also to what you just said, Erland, well, had they produced some results,
exactly,
possibly this scandal would not have happened. But now it was kind of... The central government kind of had to punish them because they squandered all this money. And probably if you look at other SOEs, you will also find waste and corruption to a degree. But yeah, as you say, as long as the goals are being met, then you're willing to look past some.
Yeah, so. I think the SOEs are increasingly kind of being assigned goals or indicators on what they should do. Mm. But there's also a list or kind of expectations that they don't do stuff that they shouldn't do. You know, that's, the semiconductor companies or SOEs are also the biggest in real estate. That's not going to, that shouldn't happen, but that's what happened, right? Because, that's where you create a lot of economic growth. And it's so, yeah, they're going to be restructuring the financial system in order to be better at managing the capital that the government has. And then I think that both the government and the SOEs who are kind of acting on the government's behalf are getting more space to implement those plans. That's the idea, or part of this idea of the big restructuring that we saw at the two sessions.
One of the persons who is believed to take a lot larger role in also with the economy going forward, who's now a vice premier as well, he was the chairman of the NDRC, He Lifeng.
Right.
It's also expected to become the next economic czar in China, taking over after Liu He. What can you say about He Lifeng, and why is he important to keep an eye on?
Yeah, no, He Lifeng is, I don't think he is from Fujian, but that's kind of where he has, I think he's actually from Shandong. But he has a long career in Fujian, similar to Xi Jinping. I mean, he's in a very interesting story. He started at the Xiamen University in early 1980s and was quickly discovered by the top professor at the university at the time, who was very influential in the setup of the Minister of Finance in China, seen as this very talented young student. And when China announced these special economic zones, Xiamen was one of them, and He Lifeng got a very central role in that zone, where they kind of did this experiments of opening up and attract foreign investments and so on. By the way, he also studied together with the current finance minister, the one Liu Kun, who will continue in his role as finance minister. So there's a kind of a group of financial experts who was given kind of a playground at the Xiamen Special Economic Zone. And a year after he started there, Xi Jinping also came as a kind of a top bureaucrat. But He Lifeng was kind of one of the architects there. So yeah, we know that these two have gone together ever since. I think the rumors that He Lifeng was Xi Jinping's best man in his wedding.
Oh, okay.
So he went around in different positions: Xiamen, Quanzhou, Fuzhou, before he was elevated to Tianjin, the new Binhai area, where he did build a lot of skyscrapers during a short period. And he, when Xi Jinping went to, became party secretary, He Lifang then went shortly after to Beijing, became the vice chairman of NDRC, which is, I think, a minister rank position.
Mm-hmm.
And was kind of deputies of all these new leading groups, including, I think deepening reform leading group, the Belt and Road, and so on.
So some analysts, or maybe some like broader stories or ways that Xi's leadership is being told, they would say sort of that, well, all these people, they are just like Xi men or just his friends. What would you say to that?
Yeah, they are his trusted advisors. That's probably correct. But I think what is very interesting with all these leaders is that they have stories and success to show to, usually early in their careers, and they'd be giving a lot of tough tasks normally. So it's not, I think it's sometimes portrayed like he's their, just their friend, but these guys are more than that. And He Lifang will be now in charge of the SOE reform, probably as Liu He's successor. He's going to, seems to have a bit different style than Liu He. Liu He was very much on kind of controlling all this overcapacity but He Lifang has kind of shown that he's more interested in beefing up a bit of activities.
Mm.
There's probably some conflicting kind of theories floating around in that circle. So it's going to be interesting to see how the new financial kind of system comes together. But there are a lot of technocrats, and He Lifang is certainly a technocrat as well. So yeah, it's he's one of those characters that we should pay attention to and see. There are some rumors that he will be kind of sitting on top of this new People's Bank in China kind of structure. Let's see if that materializes. But yeah, but again, these so they will be given kind of tough tasks and they need to perform. I think that's kind of what we also need to understand here is that, including Xi Jinping, by the way, I mean, and the task that he has set in front of himself as he's getting close to 70 years old is that he's going to make sure that China is going to be successful.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily a very easy task. So it's not the points that you're making, Mats, is that these people that come in are like they come with some baggage of expertise as well.
Because when we talked about the leadership at the party congress, you saw the new Politburo that we said that, okay, now to see who is going to get promoted, we need to still look at merits, still a meritocracy, but we also need to look at Xi loyalty. So what would you think way higher? Merits or Xi loyalty?
No, I think he has kind of made up his mind. I mean, on kind of who he trusts and learned them, seen them in action throughout many years, and kind of found the people that he wants to put into his team. So I don't think this is kind of a pick and choose kind of job. I think it's more like, let's put these guys together. But it's very important to also remember that even if you kind of come into the Politburo standing committee or Politburo or minister position, you have a big team around you still. Mm. And usually they have conflicting kind of opinions. They have a range of advisory groups, a lot of theoretical work. So, I mean, at NDRC, He Lifang was running the fiber plants, obviously. The fiber plan is considered to have more than 1 million people involved in terms of making all of these sentences that's in the final five-year plan. So yeah, there's a big kind of administrative job that, of course, based on their merits, they can make certain decisions on what should be in and what should be out. But it's wrong to see them as a kind of, you know, one-man drivers of certain policies.
So in the last part of this talk, Alan, and it's been very interesting and I think very enlightening, we wanted to take the discussion here back to the Nordics and and just talk about, like, I know that you returned from China to the Nordics quite recently.
Last summer.
Yeah. Mm. And
after 14 years almost, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. And me and Casper, we often talk about how China's being portrayed in the media, how it's being portrayed in sort of as a...
Yeah, and discussing and our knowledge level on China. Do we really know? I mean,
and what do we miss? And what should we pay attention to more in order to sort of
engage with China strategically? Because I mean, right now the discussion on China, at least in Danish media, in Danish public debate, is extremely polarized, extremely black and white. A lot of people want to paint China in the enemy picture or as a rival, systemic rival, as the EU has also labeled it, and of course also seen. I mean, a lot of people are doing like the liberal democracies versus the dictatorships and autocracies that China is a part of with Russia now and the war in Ukraine. And it's probably not that black and white. And a lot of people just flat out, I mean, we have the discussion about the two sessions that a lot of Danish medias really don't necessarily want to cover the whole thing because they don't think that their readers are going to be interested. And the readers are probably not interested in it because it's so foreign to people, like what's going on.
Right. Yeah, it's just, I mean, this is something I'm also thinking about and I've been doing throughout my career. I must say that it's very interesting working in China policy because we have mostly non-Nordic clients, you know, the big organizations and multinationals. Of course, personally, I want to work more with Norway and the Nordics. But we, of course, get very, we're smaller players usually.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I've realized that the Chinese worldview is quite an interesting one. I mean, it's based on long traditions. There's a lot of history here that has connections to who we are here in the Nordics that I've been pursuing. So I've been reading. And it took me a few years before I kind of understood because I thought, yeah, let's go back kind of to the Communist Party kind of when it started 100 years ago or the Qing Dynasty, learn a bit. But you really need to kind of learn the whole kind of
history
like of China. And
learn a lot of even maybe intellectual history also.
Yeah, I mean, there are all these breaking points in Chinese history that are so fascinating and kind of... Yeah, it's just such a shame that we don't learn this in school. So I think, I mean...
So we need more context?
Definitely. And I think that's, you know, when China is now talking about this China-style modernization or this, global civilization initiative, what kind of civilization or kind of modernization are they really talking about? And they pick a lot of their kind of ideals from their own history. And they often have a different perspectives than what we have in our part of the world. I mean, yeah, to your point that, you know, the debate in the Nordics is now very hostile. You know, that's also my kind of judgment when I went back from China last year, as I thought to myself, oh, this is going to last for a few years. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not going to be very constructive kind of from our side in terms of understanding China more. Or so I'm working on China policy, but I'm also studying. I'm using this time to kind of study a bit more, reading up on new technologies and so on. So, but I think eventually we will get back to this China issue that I've been dealing with since 2008. How do we kind of work with them?
And can we work with them? A lot of people, at least in Denmark, would argue we should not have anything to do with China. Human rights, the way they treat the Uyghurs, they're sending weapons to Russia. They're part of the war in Ukraine. They're trying to impose their model on the rest of the world.
Yeah, I'm not sure what these people who say that think, because do they think China will just disappear? Do they think like Russia will disappear? Obviously not. These people are, these are real geographies. These are real people. And in the case of China, they are increasingly influential. And they have big ideas. I will give them some credit that they know what they're doing. So yeah, it's a puzzle to me that why such a large part of kind of our societies are not really interested in learning more. That must be the number one, right? You don't need to agree immediately, but at least have this interest in understanding what is really happening. So yeah, read on Chinese history, and then personally, I'm very driven by understanding how our history has crossed. Like walking around here in Copenhagen today, I mean, you try to picture all the ships that went to the to Asia to do the trade
to Guangdong and Guangzhou.
Yeah, and I mean, there's just so much there that is not being learned and kind of remembered here. But if you go walk around in China, you can see all these old consulates, or you can see kind of traces of that we were there. And kind of our prosperity is very much built on this connection to China. China was kind of the affluent part of the world when before the Industrial Revolution. And it kind of, it's that history is just so interesting. And I think we will go back to, we need to find a space for us to kind of work together in this world that is more sustainable. And it's not only, I mean, obviously for peace in the world, but also to solve the climate change crisis. And I mean, I would give some credits for Denmark actually to build up there. I see more and more experts in Denmark, like in the energy space, there are many actually. The Energistiftelsen and others actually have a big China desk. In Norway, we have nothing like that. Nothing. I mean, the Swedish have now built a China competence center or something.
Yeah, the National China Center.
So there are things happening, but I would say we need hundreds of new China watchers, and then we need to discuss this much more. So of course, we can sit here and
but I think preaching to the choir.
Exactly. So three people is really not enough. We need hundreds, and then it's a bit strange because we have a very close relationship in China economic wise. I mean, that's the global factory of the world. We buy a lot from there. China is very important for global economy. I mean, obviously there must be, you know, obviously the companies and the ministries and so on has a lot of China competence. No, that's what you realize, and it's a bit shocking. So we have this kind of China approach, one like the what we've done for the last 20 years or so, where we kind of made China the world factory, but we don't really understand how it influences us because we haven't really done our homework. And I think it's been very sad. Now we need to use this period of you know, where there's a lot of focus on the security to understand that, okay, when we redo this kind of reconnection to China and try to create something that is more constructive, we need to take a much more serious interest in who they are, where they come from, and see if we can do something together in that respect before we start looking at how much money we can make from it.
I think a thing that really influences a lot of our talks in this podcast as well, and that will influence all Xi Jinping's and China's ambitions with the economy, is the rivalry with the U.S. That is not going to go away. It's going to continue. I mean, we have the presidential election coming up next year in the U.S., where all the anti-China rhetoric is going to get turned up to 11. There's a big debate among Chinese or American China watchers right now that the debate, the climate of the debate is so hostile on both sides of the of Congress that there's no leeway of approaching China in any way. And people are saying this is dangerous. People are being discredited for having studied China. And it's an interesting paradox that the people who know China the most and knows the most about China are not trusted for that fact alone.
And you had, there was this Jordan Snyder in
China. A recent China talk with Dennis Wilder, CIA.
And he said that at the moment, there are how many, just a couple of thousand, I think 2,000 or 3,000 American students in China, while there is 200, I think, thousand Chinese students in America.
Hillary Clinton wanted something like 100,000 or something.
They're starting banning Chinese students. I mean, if you're from China, you're not allowed access into the U.S. And I mean, the rivalry is going to affect us in the Nordics as well, in the EU. So how do you think we should navigate this? Because, I mean, that climate, and it is also affecting Xi Jinping, because we see that Chinese scholarship council students are asked to swear allegiance and come back and serve China and serve the party. So everything is like being really talked up in at an area where collaboration is becoming much more difficult than it was just 15 years ago.
So I think a lot of those questions concern kind of the security kind of realm. Is how do you protect yourself, or how do you? And I mean, the situation for us is that we are very connected to the US-led kind of, especially in Europe. We wouldn't be able necessarily to defend ourselves. So we were dependent on that NATO and so on. So that's going to be there. But I think, you know, being reading Chinese sources all the time and being influenced by that, I think it seems like the US has less interest in global affairs and capabilities as well. The government debt in the US is quite high, and unless they manage to increase taxes, they will have less people around the world. That's going to infect their abilities to govern the world. So I think that, you know, China has looked at this phenomena and thought, we're not sure if we are ready or interested in kind of taking the US role, because that comes with a lot of conflict and money and expectations of money and so on. So that's part of why the Belt and Road has partly failed for now. But you see that China now is stepping up. And I think that Xi Jinping is now in Russia, and that they did this kind of peace agreement with Russia, with Saudi Arabia and Iran, is kind of evidence that China is becoming more proactive and being more active in global affairs. But that, of course, comes with, you know, a demand or an interest in developing Chinese rules as part of the international rules. And to be honest, I think that China doesn't really have the capabilities to push that through, and they need a bit of help. I think that's where the opportunity really lies for countries like Denmark and Norway, that we can kind of guide China towards the better standards.
Yeah.
And what is happening now is that we're not really doing that. And that's really sad, to be honest.
I'm sure, I mean, it's needed. COVID must have played a huge role, because we've been unable to go to China. I mean, now that China is opening up, so we're at an interesting junction right now.
Yeah.
New party leadership, new state reforms, and China opening up again. So, and I think also coming back to this topic, why it is important to focus on the two sessions in Lianghui, because that shows us where are our strategic opportunities to engage with China in the wisest ways that we can benefit from the most, and try to turn as much as small countries as Denmark and Norway can do, influence China in so much of a right direction, and have a room for forum for debate, discussions with China.
Yeah, I think we need to do our homework first, though. I think we need to, yeah. I mean, we need more people who do their homework on China. I mean, the Belt and Road Third Summit is coming up. It's only the third. I think that they're already, it was kind of stopped during the COVID. And it seems like France and Germany will participate. What are the Nordics country doing?
Yeah.
So I think on that note, I want to ask you a final question, Erlend. This has been a really fascinating talk with many great points, and we learned a lot. I wanted to ask you, when you said we need to do our homework, well, for young aspiring China watchers who may be listening to this program, what would you advise them to do if they want to work in this field, or maybe go work in China policy, or maybe a similar kind of institution?
Yeah, there are many kind of China watcher companies around that kind of, you know, the new digital tools that makes translations and the kind of summaries of what is happening in China much easier. But you need to, of course, step your feet on the ground there as well. Understand that China is not a monolith. You know, seek different experiences. So one, I mean, obviously, like I said, you can study the Chinese history, and then you can start following closely, you know, policy developments, policy debates. But then, of course, you need to look at the practice as well and understand that Fujian is not Shandong, and learn all these regional kind of differences. That's kind of a job to begin with. And then see if you can find your role in that. I think there are quite a few people around that are kind of very general, that don't really have gotten to kind of a more specific kind of expertise. But that's obviously what you got to do. You can't be we to be a kind of a China generalist is not it's not easy.
No.
I mean, in China policy, we're very lucky because we have people who have been in China, been watching China since the 1970s. And so, you know, when they speak, you listen, you know, and then of course you can repeat a few of their points, but I think it's not everyone is that lucky, I think. But and then develop your kind of own path. And then I hope that we together with all this kind of community, hopefully being developed with time, is that we can kind of challenge each other and think. So there's a tendency, I would say, with China watchers and China experts to kind of think that you have the answer. And the interesting thing with China is, of course, that they love contradictions. So they can, of course, if you want to find evidence for China is really bad, you will find that. If you want to find evidence for China is very peaceful, you will find that. But, you know, you probably need to learn how to balance all these contradictions what is China.
Yeah.
I also want to ask, also on behalf of our listeners, do you have any recommendations for our listeners? I mean, if you've heard a good podcast on China, read an interesting article, a blog post, or a book, anything you would want to recommend that people should look into?
There are many, many... what should I say? I mean, I usually, I find it interesting to read Chinese news. So Chushi or Renmin Ribao or kind of. I usually when they come out, I just check what's there.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of jargons and a lot of kind of. But I think for me, my current stage, that's kind of where I'm kind of starting. And then because there are many China watchers that don't really do the basics. And I think that's what the party is kind of pushing through their own propaganda channels. And Renmin Ribao and Chushi are kind of the two main ones, I would say. It's kind of 101 for understanding China today. Luckily, there is this great Indian Substack guy who translates Renmin Ribao everything. Yeah. It's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. Because when you say Renmin Ribao, for example, or Chushi, it's about reading the signals in them, right? As in, because that's something like, was it Susan Shirk?
Yeah.
Really good at this, obviously. Dave Kelly, many of you guys at China Policy are very skilled in this as well. So basically, often that's where you're going to see the first tweaks of policy.
Yeah, exactly. And so when you start to read the articles of the minister, which is super long, and he's just it feels like he's repeating a lot of the jargons and you read it already. Usually, if you start looking carefully, and this is what I've learned with time, is that
the difference in the detail.
There's one new thing in there, and I'm going to find it. And that's kind of, they kind of packages into this, rhetoric and so on. But that's usually where you're going to find it. In fact, I remember I was probably one of the first people that noticed Belt and Road because he said it on this trip to Kazakhstan.
Yeah.
And who reads that stuff, right? In Chinese. I don't think they didn't even know about it in kind of the, it was one of those studies that he just popped up. It took a few months before the policy community got up with it, even in China.
Wow.
But once you read it, it's like, well, it was Itairu. What does that really mean? So I started reaching out to people I know who could have an idea what does and it turns out no one knows.
No one knew.
But I remember, okay, we got to find out this Itairu. If Xi Jinping says Itairu, you better know what it is, right? So I'm not sure if that happens because there are so many people watch everything that they do now. But this was in 2013, I think, or something.
Yeah.
So back then, it was, China Policy was one of the few that really did it, kind of followed China policy structurally.
Yep. Wow. Well, with the recommendation, People's Daily, Renmin Ribao, and Chushi. I mean, even for young listeners who are studying China studies, who can read Chinese or want to practice their Chinese, there you go. That could be a career path.
Motivations to read that stuff, though. that's the thing,
Alan, thank you so much for being a guest at our podcast.
Thank you so much.
And to our listeners, hope you enjoyed it, even though it was in English. I assume that most of our listeners can understand English. It's a good way to have foreign guests as well, so everyone can understand. Vi kunne sikkert også have taget det på dansk.
Ja, vi kunne jo have taget det, når de forstår norsk, ikke sant?
Ja. Det måske gør vores lytter også, men tusind tak, fordi du kom med, og tak til dig, Mads, også for at være her.
I lige måde.
Som altid en fornøjelse at nørde Gina.
Ja.
Virkelig i dybden, og forhåbentlig kan folk også se, hvorfor det er, de to møder, de er vigtige. Mads og jeg, vi er tilbage inden længe med normale Kina-nørderne, og vi har flere specials på vej. Så tak for den her gang.